Welcome to This Week in Ophthalmology. This week we're covering 9 notable papers spanning key advancements in retinal disease management, corneal and ocular surface health, and new predictive models for optic nerve pathology. Let's dive in. Let's start with new insights into age-related macular degeneration and diabetic eye disease. In a target trial emulation using data from the TriNetX United States Collaborative Network, researchers evaluated whether dopamine-enhancing therapies could reduce the risk of converting from dry to neovascular age-related macular degeneration. Analyzing adult patients with non-neovascular disease over a 3-year period, they found that those prescribed levodopa with or without carbidopa had a significant reduction in conversion risk, showing roughly a 30% lower rate compared to matched controls. The study utilized a target trial emulation framework to minimize confounding, comparing new users of levodopa or dopamine receptor D2 agonists against patients prescribed pantoprazole or gabapentin as active controls. This rigorous methodology strengthens the finding that levodopa may play an active role in stabilizing the retinal pigment epithelium or choroidal vasculature, whereas direct receptor agonists like pramipexole or ropinirole do not share this protective association. This connects directly to a major study from the Ophthalmology Journal using the Intelligent Research Insight, or IRIS, registry, which investigated whether cataract surgery accelerates conversion to neovascular age-related macular degeneration. Looking at over 80,000 eyes matched for baseline characteristics, the authors found a modest overall increase in conversion risk with a hazard ratio of 1.22. However, a deeper time-varying analysis revealed that this risk was highly concentrated in the first year following surgery, where the hazard ratio was about 2.5 and declined to non-significance by the fourth year. This pattern strongly suggests that the apparent risk is driven by intensive post-operative surveillance and the detection of pre-existing, unrecognized neovascular disease, rather than a true biological effect of cataract extraction. This is highly relevant for clinical practice, as it suggests we do not need to delay or avoid cataract surgery out of fear of accelerating macular degeneration, but we should remain vigilant in our preoperative and early postoperative assessments. Moving from age-related macular degeneration to diabetic macular edema, a nationwide registry-based cohort study published in the American Journal of Ophthalmology looked at the critical clinical scenario of patients returning after being lost to follow-up for 6 months or longer. Among nearly 1,000 patients who returned with active edema, about 46% presented with stabilized visual acuity, while 54% had experienced a decline. When antivascular endothelial growth factor therapy was restarted, those who returned with stabilized vision actually had a much lower rate of visual improvement. Only about 33% gained vision, compared to 62% of those who had returned with vision loss. Crucially, patients who returned with stabilized vision of 20/50 or better achieved no visual gain at all, despite anatomical improvement on optical coherence tomography. This suggests that for patients returning with moderate to good stable vision, immediate resumption of antivascular endothelial growth factor injections may offer limited functional benefits, and clinicians should carefully weigh retreatment against observation or alternative therapies. Early detection of diabetic retinal damage remains a priority, and a prospective cohort study in JAMA Ophthalmology investigated neuroretinal layer thinning in youth with type 1 diabetes. Part of the ACCESS-2 study, researchers examined nearly 300 pediatric patients using optical coherence tomography. They found that thinning of the ganglion cell plus inner plexiform layer and the outer retinal layers was significantly associated with higher hemoglobin A1c levels, even in youth who did not yet show any clinically visible diabetic retinopathy. The multivariable models demonstrated that for every 1% increase in hemoglobin A1c, there was a measurable decrease in the thickness of both the ganglion cell, plus inner plexiform layer and the outer retinal layers. This is a vital piece of evidence showing that systemic glycemic control directly impacts neuroretinal structure long before microvascular lesions like microaneury SMS or hemorrhages become visible on standard clinical exams. Let's turn our attention to the cornea and ocular surface, where several new publications challenge current treatment paradigms and highlight systemic medication side effects. First, in infectious keratitis, the 12-month results of the randomized double-masked REAGIR trial were. The trial compared adjunctive Rose Bengal photodynamic therapy with green light irradiation to a sham procedure in 330 patients with fungal, acanthamoeba, or culture-negative corneal ulcers. Unfortunately, the long-term data confirmed the 6-month findings. There was no significant difference between the groups in best spectacle-corrected visual acuity, scar size, or rates of corneal perforation and therapeutic penetrating keratoplasty at 1 year. The lack of benefit was consistent across all subgroups, including fungal and acanthamoeba infections. This suggests that while Rose Bengal photodynamic therapy has demonstrated powerful in vitro antimicrobial properties, translating these effects to the complex in vivo corneal environment remains a significant hurdle, potentially due to limited tissue penetration or the rapid neutralizing capacity of corneal tissue. In oncology-related ocular side effects, a retrospective study in the American Journal of Ophthalmology systematically evaluated corneal changes associated with cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6 inhibitors, which are widely used for hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. Because these drugs block the cell cycle, they can impair the highly proliferative corneal epithelium. The study compared women on combination therapy to those on aromatase inhibitors alone and healthy controls. They found that punctate epitheliopathy was remarkably common in the combination group, affecting over 44% of eyes compared to less than 5% in the other groups. Furthermore, moderate to severe epitheliopathy and vortex keratopathy occurred exclusively in patients receiving the cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6 inhibitors. Because these patients often report low symptom scores, proactive corneal evaluation with fluorescein staining is highly recommended to catch these silent epithelial alterations early. On a broader scale of systemic medication effects, a systematic review and meta-analysis in the American Journal of Ophthalmology explored the controversial association between statin therapy and dry eye disease. Pooling data from 6 observational studies involving over 560,000 patients, the authors identified a small but statistically significant positive association, with statin users having about a 9% increased odds of dry eye disease, translating to roughly 10 additional cases per 1,000 patients. Although the certainty of the evidence was graded as very low due to study design limitations, the consistent direction of the association across studies suggests that clinicians should actively monitor ocular surface symptoms in patients taking statins, especially those with pre-existing dry eye risk factors. Our final theme explores predictive modeling for optic nerve damage and the structural biology of visual pigments. Managing highly myopic eyes presents a significant diagnostic challenge, particularly in distinguishing glaucomatous from non-glaucomatous optic neuropathy. The British Journal of Ophthalmology published a 2-continent eye study, which developed and validated predictive equations for these conditions using data from over 35,000 eyes across 5 large population-based cohorts. The models incorporate axial length, age, intraocular pressure, ethnicity, and coexisting macular degeneration. The clinical utility of these equations is striking. For an individual with an axial length of 28 mm and an intraocular pressure of 22 mm of mercury, the probability of glaucomatous optic neuropathy rises from 3.5% at age 30 to over 60% by age 75. If the axial length is 30 mm, that probability jumps to over 75% at age 75, while the probability of non-glaucomatous optic neuropathy reaches over 68%. These equations provide clinicians with a valuable tool to estimate long-term risk and tailor monitoring intervals for highly myopic patients. Finally, in a milestone paper for basic visual science, the journal Science published the first-ever cryo-electron microscopy structures of human cone visual pigments. While the structure of rod-based rhodopsin has been known for over 2 decades, the structures of the long, middle, and short wavelength-sensitive cone opacins had remained unsolved. The researchers successfully resolved all 3 human cone opacins bound to a G protein and all transretinal in their active states. The structures reveal significant differences from rhodopsin, identifying a unique counterion site in the red and green opacins and a distinct ring of serine surrounding the retinal in the blue opsin. These structural findings explain how specific amino acid substitutions fine-tune spectral sensitivity, providing a molecular explanation for color vision deficiencies and the fundamental differences in how our eyes transition between rod and cone vision. If you only have time for 1 paper this week, make it the IRIS Registry Study on Cataract Surgery and Dry Age-Related Macular Degeneration Conversion in the journal Ophthalmology. This massive real-world analysis provides reassuring evidence that the apparent spike in neovascular conversion after cataract extraction is likely a temporary artifact of increased clinical surveillance rather than a biological consequence of surgery, allowing us to confidently counsel our patients with dry age-related macular degeneration. Here are the key takeaways from this week in ophthalmology. First, The 12-month follow-up of the REAGIR trial confirms that adjunctive Rose Bengal photodynamic therapy does not improve visual or anatomical outcomes in moderate to severe infectious keratitis, suggesting we should stick to standard antimicrobial protocols. Second, when retreatments are initiated for diabetic macular edema patients returning after being lost to follow-up, those with stable baseline vision of 20/50 or better show poor visual recovery despite anatomical improvement, signaling a need for cautious individualized retreatment decisions. Third, patients undergoing cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6 inhibitor therapy for breast cancer have a high rate of silent but severe punctate epitheliopathy and vortex keratopathy, making routine fluorescein staining essential during their oncologic treatment. Fourth, the two-continent eye study provides validated equations showing that the risk of both glaucomatous and non-glaucomatous optic neuropathies increases exponentially with age in highly myopic eyes, especially when axial length exceeds 28 mm. And finally, systemic statin use is associated with a small but consistent increase in dry eye disease risk, so be sure to inquire about lipid-lowering therapies in patients presenting with unexplained ocular surface irritation. That's your roundup for this week in ophthalmology. The full transcript and references are available on the episode page in your Audio Scholar library. This is an AI-curated summary. For clinical decisions, always consult primary sources and current guidelines. See you next week. If this weekly briefing is useful, follow the show in your podcast app, so new episodes arrive automatically. And for audio briefings on your own clinical questions and papers, visit audioscholar.cc. This is an automated summary generated by artificial intelligence, which can make mistakes. Always review the original source materials.